making TV special.
Donuts. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means.
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
It was 28 years ago today that John Lennon was gunned down by a deranged fan outside his apartment on Central Park West. Hundreds of fans are expected to gather at Strawberry Field in Central Park today to honor the former Beatle. Lennon's killer, Mark David Chapman, is serving a life sentence for the murder. He was denied parole earlier this year. John Lennon would have been 68 years old this year.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of tricky dick. He's gonna mother Herbert's up so meek, but just a pocket full of holes. Money for dough, money for rose.
That's all we want. It's the truth. And that's why I'm doing this. My name is James Evan Pilato. Welcome to MediaMonarchy.com. The B-side of episode 102. Coming to you from my bedroom in downtown Portland, Oregon. And kicking it off with John Lennon. Give me some truth from his album, Imagine. And of course, imagine John Lennon at 68. Which is how old he would have been had he not been gunned down 28 years ago last Monday, December 8th. 28th anniversary of John Lennon's murder. So I've got several links, and we've also got the New York Daily News. And, of course, you can read about Mark David Chapman and who his father was. It's always a lone nutter with military intelligence connections. But anyway, from the New York Daily News, it was 28 years ago last Monday that singer-songwriter John Lennon was fatally shot outside his Upper West Side apartment building by a deranged fan. Every year since the tragic event on December 8th, 1980, fans have gathered to pay tribute to the gifted musician near the site of the shooting. Despite the bitter temperatures, hundreds of people are expected to gather, and did, at Strawberry Fields, the memorial garden in Central Park that was created as a tribute to the ex-Beatle in 1985. It's located across from the Dakota, where Lennon lived with Yoko Ono when he was killed. A quick word about the Dakota, just finished rewatching for me Roman Polanski's 1968 film Rosemary's Baby, where a lot of the external shots of the creepy building that they live in are actually at the Dakota in New York City. So you see shots within Rosemary's Baby where it's like, that's pretty much right where Lennon was gunned down. And that just ties into all the bizarre connections with Roman Polanski and his Sharon Tate murdered wife and Charles Manson, and I believe Anton LaVey sneaks in and plays the devil in the film. But anyway, I'm getting off into Rosemary's Baby talk. And it's a week of ugly anniversaries. So, of course, starting it off, as always, with a hat tip to John Lennon. And, of course, there's all the interesting things about his FBI files and all of that. But we're not going to get into that. We're going to jump to the second big anniversary of the last week. That catalyzing event, the old Pearl Harbor. So, of course, December 7th, a date which will live in infamy. In honor of the 67th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the old gray lady, or the New York Times, as you may know her, offers up the debunking of the old catalyzing event. Now, isn't it interesting whenever the anniversaries roll around, the mainstream corporate press have to always peddle out something new to try and disclaim the lingering and pertinent unanswered questions. Conspiracies. The New York Times debunks Pearl Harbor prior knowledge. This actually, I believe, ran in the New York Times the day before on the 6th. But here you go. It has remained one of World War II's most enduring mysteries, one that resonated decades later after 9/11. Who in Washington knew what and when before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941? Specifically, who heard or saw a transcript of a Tokyo shortwave radio news broadcast that was interrupted by a prearranged coded weather report? The weather bulletin signaled Japanese diplomats around the world to destroy confidential documents and codes because war with the U.S., the Soviet Union, or Britain was beginning. In testimony for government inquiries, witnesses said that the, quote, winds execute, end quote, message was intercepted as early as December 4th, 3 days before the attack. But after analyzing American and foreign intelligence sources and decrypted cables, historians for the National Security Agency concluded in a documentary history released last week that whatever other warnings reached Washington about the attack, the winds execute message was not one of them. A Japanese message intercepted and decoded on November 19th at an American monitoring station in Bainbridge Island, Washington State, appeared to lay out the winds execute situation. If diplomatic relations were in danger with one of the three countries, a coded phrase would be repeated as a special weather bulletin twice in the middle and twice at the end of the daily Japanese language news broadcast. East wind rain would mean the United States. North wind cloudy, the Soviet Union, and west wind clear, Britain. In the history called West Wind Clear, published by the NSA's Center for Cryptologic History, the authors Robert J. Hanyok, H-A-N-Y-O-K, and the late David Mowry, M-O-W-R-Y, attribute accounts of the message being broadcast to the flawed or fabricated memory of some witnesses, perhaps to deflect culpability from other officials for the United States' insufficient readiness for war. Digging into the links here, we can of course go to the Wall Street Journal and of course the NSA themselves and their page for the Center for Cryptologic History. We've also got the Advertiser.com, DailyBulletin.com, OldThinkerNews.com, again, the Wall Street Journal, Wikipedia, and more. So, when I first looked up Robert J. Hanyoc, he has actually done good work showing that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was staged. But here he's debunking some Pearl Harbor prior knowledge. So this is interesting. It always seems the debunkers always have to keep beaten back with new things and new reports, but the conspiracy theorist questions remain generally the same. So if we hit my flashback link at the bottom, History Channel, Conspiracy, FDR, and Pearl Harbor, we can see that last year on the anniversary, that's 2 years ago. So December 7th, 2006, on Media Monarchy, I posted up the History Channel documentary, Conspiracy, FDR, and Pearl Harbor, and you can still watch that whole, I believe, 45 or an hour long documentary from the History Channel. And hit that link and see the blow-up of the front page of the Hilo advertiser that ran a couple days before December 7th that basically says Japanese may strike Pearl Harbor over the weekend. So somebody knew something. And again, the rabbit hole is there for you. One sidebar note for you. My man Alex in Germany posted a comment on this, veering off into some of the latest 9/11 inside job Mumbai attacks related information, and that's about Hamid Ghul, but I believe we're going to get to that a little bit later. Now, third anniversary, the one closest to us, and this is Wednesday, December 10th. Gary Webb's suicide, 4 years later. And there's an interesting piece written by Robert Perry on Consortium News. And Robert Perry actually had done a lot of work with the late Gary Webb. His article up on Consortium News on the fourth anniversary of Gary Webb's suicide, "We All Failed Gary Webb." Since Gary Webb's suicide 4 years ago, I've written annual retrospectives about the late journalist's important contribution to the historical record, that being, he forced devastating admissions from the CIA about drug trafficking by the Nicaraguan Contra rebels under the protection of the Reagan administration in the 1980s. And each time I've written one of these stories, again, Robert Perry writes, I've received emails attacking my acceptance of the fact that Webb committed suicide on the night of December 9th, 2004. Some people want to believe that he was really assassinated by the CIA or some other government agency. But the evidence of his carefully planned suicide, as he suffered deep pain as a pariah in his profession who could no longer earn a living, actually points to something possibly even more tragic. Webb ended his life because people who should have supported his work simply couldn't be bothered. Though Gary Webb was horribly betrayed by his colleagues in the news business, and especially his editors at the San Jose Mercury News, he was also taken advantage of by people in the progressive movement who sometimes exploited his celebrity by having him speak at their events for little or no money. There's a deeply troubling attitude within the American progressive movement that it bears next to no responsibility for people who speak truth to power and suffer horrible consequences, as Webb did. While sometimes progressives cheer the heroism, they rarely back it up with anything sustainable. That's just the first little bit of Robert Perry's rather scathing and interesting tribute to the late Gary Webb. Going along with this, there's actually a video series up on YouTube, up on Google Video, and I have the link for you. Cocaine and the Contras.
And the evidence was pretty overwhelming that the Contra units were dealing in drugs, as well as engaged in some fighting, although they seemed to be more interested in the business side of this than the war side of this in many cases. So that's what we discovered. And Barger and I then flew back to Washington. And Barger was very excited, said, we got the story. And I said, well, the hard part is now to come. And the hard part in journalism these days, especially on this kind of a topic, is to get the story to print. And I knew that the AP editors would not be thrilled with what we were coming back with. The pressure in Washington in the 80s was already building. Anytime a reporter found information that was derogatory about the Contras, that reporter and his editors, bureau chiefs, everybody, could expect to be expect to come under severe criticism. There was a special team that had been set up by the National Security Council called the Public Diplomacy Team. And they would literally go to your offices. Otto Reich ran it. The guy who oversaw it day-to-day was Walter Raymond Jr. Walter Raymond Jr. was a 30-year propaganda specialist from the CIA. And he'd been transferred by William Casey over to the National Security Council to run this operation. Casey, the head of the CIA, personally oversaw this effort to do what they called, inside their own operation, perception management. The goal of this operation that they ran, we have the documents on now, was to manage the perceptions of the American people on how they would see what was going on in Central America.
And so we spent the next 6 months working on this thing, and it culminated in the three-part series that we printed in August, entitled Dark Alliance. And basically what the series says, well, let me start out by saying what the series doesn't say, because there seems to be a lot of confusion about that. It does not say that the CIA brainstormed a genocidal plot against black America. It doesn't say that at all. It doesn't say that the CIA masterminded the influx of crack into America. What it says is that this Nicaraguan Contra cocaine ring brought tons of cocaine into California, brought tons of cocaine into the South Central, and sold it to Freeway Rick, who turned it into crack and spread it first through Los Angeles and then through the rest of the country. It also talks about how they were meeting with the leaders of the Contra Army. One of the guys was on TV the other day, Adolfo Calero. We came up with a picture of Adolfo Calero in a kitchen in San Francisco standing next to Norwin Meneses. Which, incidentally, when I interviewed Meneses, he initially denied that he had anything to do with Contras, and I pulled out this picture, showed it to him, and he goes, "Okay, you got me." And he was pretty easy. He was pretty easy. We also discovered that, and Danilo Blandón testified to this when he took the stand against Rick Ross in March, that his first introduction to cocaine trafficking came when he went down to Honduras and met with a man named Colonel Enrique Bermudez, who was the military commander of the FDN, handpicked by the CIA, paid by the CIA to run that army. And Enrique Bermudez told him, "You guys need to go to California and raise some money for the FDN, and the ends justify the means." He testified to that in court as a government witness under oath. And I mean, this is a story that Bob can attest. I mean, this is historical fact. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is not, some people in a back room thinking about how they can smear Ronald Reagan after all these years. This is a fact. These are historical facts. And that's one of the beauties of doing the story 10 years later, so we've got a paper trail a mile wide. Bob, unfortunately, was doing it while it was going on, which is a very much more difficult story to nail down, because you've got people in the midst of committing criminal acts that really don't want that exposed. So at any rate, I think there's more information coming. You know, people need to get a hold of their congressman and make sure that this one doesn't get shut down like the Kerry Committee investigation got shut down. And maybe it takes 10 years for the truth to come out, but it comes out eventually.
The late, great Gary Webb, author of Dark Alliance. You must get that book. The man who basically outed the CIA and drug trafficking and the Contra rebels and that whole ugly, ugly underbelly. So we salute him. And that's the third of three anniversaries. John Lennon, Pearl Harbor, Gary Webb. We're now going to get to the present. And we're going to shift gears and discuss EnviroHealth. So post it up on MediaMonarchy.com. EnviroHealth, water, web, weather, West Virginia, and Wales. And not necessarily in that order. First up, CNBC and statins and communist plots. This is a video up on YouTube. It's, of course, the talking head douchebags up on CNBC. But the uploader on YouTube notes that makers of Crestor, now claim that people with normal cholesterol are also at risk for heart attack. Their study shows that if this group has a high level of HSCRP, they lower their risk for heart attacks and arterial disease. This even though HSCRP indicates generalized inflammation, not just arterial and heart. Of course, they didn't address the negative side effects of lowering your cholesterol below normal levels. Dr. Nissan of the Cleveland Clinic admits they'll now get to treat a lot more people. Yay! One CNBC host asked, no joke, why statins aren't put in the water supply. The response, of course, is that that would be a communist plot, like fluoride.
This is frustrating to me, Mike, because we know so little about what's going on here, really, when it comes right down to it. So high levels of cholesterol in the blood don't necessarily cause heart disease?
They do cause heart disease.
Now you're talking about average levels of cholesterol in the blood somehow are contributing to heart disease as well, right?
No.
Lowering cholesterol,
but with a high level or elevated CRP, if you have over 2, these people in this study, I think, had something at a level of 4.
But the bottom line is it's not just cholesterol that you should be watching.
Right, so when you go in for your blood test now, especially you, Joe, being over a certain age, you're going to say, not only check my HDL and LDL, make sure they put HSCRP in there as well.
Why don't they just put statins in the water or something?
A lot of people have said that, and they are in water, in fact.
Yeah. That would be a communist plot, just like fluoride.
That's just the last couple moments of the CNBC clip. Host recommends statins be put in the water supply, so you don't hear Dr. Nissan from the Cleveland Clinic say that, well, we're going to get to treat a lot more people, and of course, it's the disease industry. You should look at it and think of it that way. And it's, you know, fluoride and communist plot. It wasn't communist, remember? The Nazis did it. But who, yeah. Who's teaching who what? This from the independent.co.uk. Pollution causing feminization of males across multiple species. So, haha, it's official. Men really are the weaker sex. The male gender is in danger with incalculable consequences for both humans and wildlife. Startling scientific research from around the world reveals the research, to be detailed in the most comprehensive report yet published, shows that a host of common chemicals is feminizing males of every class of vertebrate animals, from fish to mammals, including people. Backed by some of the world's leading scientists who say that it waves a red flag for humanity and shows that evolution itself is being disrupted, the report comes out at a particularly sensitive time for ministers. On Wednesday, Britain will lead opposition to propose new European controls on pesticides, many of which have been found to have gender-bending effects. And there's other links to other independent articles in there, as well as chemtrust.org.uk. And, of course, download the MEG.3 PDF of the report, Male Wildlife Under Threat 2008 Full Report from ChemTrust. And there are other links in there to ctv.ca and others as we slide down the ugly Enviro Health post here. Next to Wired Science, synthetic viruses could explain animal-to-human jumps in a technical tour de force with potentially profound implications for the study of emerging diseases. Researchers have built the largest ever self-replicating organism from scratch. The organism is a virus based on genome sequences taken from a bat-borne version of SARS, a lethal respiratory disease that jumped from animals to humans in 2002. The synthetic virus could help explain how SARS evolved, and the same approach could be used to investigate other species-hopping killers. This gives us a system to more quickly answer the questions of where a virus came from, of how to develop vaccines and treatments for a brand new virus that leaps from humans like SARS did. Said Vanderbilt University microbiologist Mark Dennison. So we have synthetic viruses Jumping from Animal to Human. And there's links in there to redorbit.com and sciencedaily.com and pnas.org and thetennessean.com. But that segues quite nicely into our next report from the Daily Mail, again out of the UK. 21st century black plague could spread from rats to humans. Try as I might, I couldn't find that these two reports were connected. Different scientists involved and slight variations in what they're talking about. I couldn't quite wrap my brain around when I was posting up two different stories trying to figure out, I was like, is this the same story? But no, it isn't. This is the second story. 21st century black plague could spread from rats to humans, from the Daily Mail. A new plague which jumps from rats to humans has been discovered by scientists. Fears are growing that increasing numbers of brown rats, the most common kind in Europe, are carrying a strain of bacteria that can cause serious illness in humans, from heart disease to infection of the spleen and nervous system. The new strain of bacteria called Bartonella roccalimae, and the first word Bartonella and roccalimae, the link's there for you. It's Latin. What do you want? The new strain of bacteria called Bartonella roccalimae is spread between rats by fleas, Taiwanese researchers have said. And again, links to Science Daily and Wikipedia and themedguru.com, and of course, the journal from which this report comes from. I believe you have to pay for it, but you can check out the abstract. So there's two stories in a row of viruses jumping from animals to humans. Some of them are natural. Some of them, oh, hell, we're just creating them ourselves in a lab. Whoops. But that's all right, because our good friend Google will keep track of it all. Back to the New York Times. Google uses web searches to track flu's spread. There's a new common symptom of the flu, in addition to the usual aches, coughs, fevers, and sore throats. Turns out a lot of ailing Americans enter phrases like, quote, flu symptoms, end quote, into Google and other search engines before they call their doctors. That simple act, multiplied across millions of keyboards and homes around the country, has given rise to a new early warning system for fast-spreading flu outbreaks called Google Flu Trends. Its new service at google.org/flutrends analyzes those searches as they come in, creating graphs and maps of the country that ideally will show where the flu is spreading. Thanks, Google. Do you think they're working on google.org/SARS trends or pandemic trends? I bet they are. Jesus, and again, you know, I shouldn't laugh at all this because it's all completely fucking off the charts, ridiculous, and when you have it all laid out, and I've tried to lay these out where they flow one into the other, it paints a fucking ridiculous picture. Indonesian AIDS patients face microchip monitoring. Have you heard me mention that before? If you're a long-time listener to the show, you've heard me rant about that. And so here we go, from the Associated Press. Lawmakers in Indonesia's remote province of Papua, P-A-P-U-A, Lawmakers in Indonesia's remote province of Papua have thrown their support behind a controversial bill requiring some HIV/AIDS patients to be implanted with microchips, part of extreme efforts to monitor the disease. Local health workers and AIDS activists call the plan abhorrent. People with AIDS aren't animals. We have to respect their rights, said a prominent Papuan activist whose name I won't attempt to pronounce. But legislator John Manansgang said by implanting small computer chips beneath the skin of, quote, sexually aggressive patients, authorities would be in a better position to identify, track, and ultimately punish those who deliberately infect others, with up to 6 months in jail or a $5,000 fine. It, of course, sets this story up talking about what was a real case that turned into the whole strain of, I believe, urban legends and stories and things about the people and getting other people infected with AIDS on purpose as an angry revenge on the world. So that's what they're referencing here, is, you know, tracking the aggressive patients. But again, we even have the idea said by, of course, the prominent activists who's saying that this idea is, of course, abhorrent. They do say that people with AIDS aren't animals, because we've already gotten to the point now where we've already implanted all our animals with RFID chips. Moving to the Washington Post, NBC fires Weather Channel Environmental Unit. NBC Universal made the first of potentially several rounds of staffing cuts at the Weather Channel, axing the entire staff of Forecast Earth, the environmental program that was on during the middle of NBC's Green Week, as well as several on-camera meteorologists. The layoffs totaled about 10% of the workforce and are among the first major changes made since NBC completed its purchase of the venerable Weather Network in September. So there's NBC kicking out the environmental group that actually came from the Weather Channel. So, of course, probably the people who actually know maybe what is going on. So we got to fire those guys. Just like, of course, the founder of the Weather Channel says that the man-made global warming hoax is just that. It's not saying there's not climate change, not saying man doesn't damage the environment. But I think he knows that a global tax is global government. Maybe he doesn't think that. Maybe that's me projecting onto him. Here's an ugly update on a story we do follow periodically here on MediaMonarchy.com, and that is, of course, the whales versus military sonar. So the latest from McClatchy, Supreme Court allows sonar. That's, of course, called damaging to whales. Supreme Court ruled last Wednesday that the Navy could use sonar in submarine hunting training exercises off Southern California without heeding restrictions imposed by lower court to protect whales and dolphins. The High Court didn't question the scientific basis of concern about harm to marine animals, but ruled that the Navy's need for the exercises was more important. You can, of course, hit the flashback going back to January of this year. Navy must cut sonar use off California. And, of course, now the Supreme Court says no. Sidebar about the Supreme Court is, of course, they also said no to even hearing the case about Mr. Obama's shady citizenship. But we'll get on to that tomorrow. Another one out of, I believe, New Zealand from Scoop. Of course, Scoop Action Alert, protect Oregon's ancient forests. However, we're going to get a few ugly West Virginia stories, some good, some bad. However, being aware of the action going on in my home state. Company fires workers for abusing turkeys in West Virginia. This, of course, from the Associated Press. Several workers at a West Virginia turkey plant have been fired after they were caught on film abusing birds. Avigen Turkeys spokeswoman Sandy Hoffman said Monday the employees, including a supervisor, were released around Thanksgiving. The abuse was disclosed last month by People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, of course, PETA.org, which released undercover video recordings of workers punching, kicking, and beating live turkeys. PETA released a statement last Monday saying it's asking prosecutors in Greenbrier and Monroe counties to press criminal charges. The company says in a statement that it's taking steps to ensure similar incidents don't happen again. It did not elaborate on what changes it would make. And there are links to the Seattle Times and other Examiner reports, as well as the New York Times. Bank of America to stop financing mountaintop coal mining. That's from thinkprogress.org. However, another from the Associated Press, activists keep heat on Governor Manchin over Coal River Mountain. Environmentalists will keep the heat on Governor Joe Manchin over Massey Energy's planned mountaintop removal mine on the Coal River Mountain. Whitesville-based Coal River Mountain Watch will hold press conferences in Charleston and Beckley on December 9th to discuss a study it's commissioned. While Richmond, Virginia-based Massey wants to mine 6,000 acres, environmentalists are trying to pressure the mountain for a wind farm. The news conference will focus on research by Downstream Strategies of Morgantown, West Virginia. It shows wind development is a wise use not just for Coal River Mountain, but for other parts of southern West Virginia. Manchin has declined to intervene in the dispute, saying it's inappropriate for him to interfere with the regulatory process. There are links in there for you to read more about Coal River Mountain and link to Downstream Strategies and Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Activists keep the heat on the governor about mountaintop removal, and at least as we just heard previously, Bank of America is going to stop financing mountaintop coal mining. And if you'll recall a few months ago, back when the campaigns were going on, that McCain had a funny gaffe where he basically said that, yeah, I'm against mountaintop coal mining. And his staff said, well, no, we're not. And they saw the video of him saying it, so yeah, I guess we are against that now. Another one, the last one, about my home state of West Virginia. Bottom drops out of West Virginia's recycling industry. That's another one from the Associated Press, and another one, unfortunately, that shows you that there ain't no money in it. Nobody's going to do it, unfortunately. Finally, in this EnviroHealth post, one last note about global warming. UN blowback. More than 650 international scientists dissent over man-made global warming claims. The UN Global Warming Conference, currently underway in Poland, is about to face a serious challenge from over 650 dissenting scientists from around the globe who are criticizing the climate claims made by the UN IPCC and former Vice President Al Gore. Set for release this week, a newly updated U.S. Senate minority report features the dissenting voices of over 650 international scientists, many current and former UN IPCC scientists who have now turned against the UN. The report has added about 250 scientists and growing in 2008 to the over 400 scientists who spoke out in 2007. The over 650 dissenting scientists are more than 12 times the number of UN scientists who authored the media-hyped IPCC 2007 Summary for Policymakers. This comes from epw.senate.gov, U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. So there are links to the full printable PDFs and the intros and all that for you. More dissent, thankfully, against the global warming claims. And that's a whole sticky wicket that I'm not going to get into right now. We're going to shift into our last chunk of stories, and they're going to be difficult. It's the Mumbai attack. And all the updates, and the false flags, and UK intel ops, and questions, and foreknowledge, and hoax calls, and double cover. Two massive postings on MediaMonarchy.com. But actually, a sidebar note first. I was lucky enough to see a private secret screening the other night, at about midnight, of Danny Boyle's fantastic new film, Slumdog Millionaire, which mostly takes place in Mumbai, India. So I thought that was kind of an interesting tie-in, and the film is really well done. It's really amazing. Danny Boyle has a way of telling a conventional story in an amazing way, and of course you've seen Trainspotting and 28 Days Later, I'm sure, but you should also, of course, check out Shallow Grave, or Millions, or Sunshine. So, interesting media-related sidebar. And got to sit in an empty theater. Basically, a friend of ours is a projectionist. When they get the movies in advance, a few days before it's going to run, they have to put it all together, to put the reels together on the platter and run it and make sure it's all good. So, we went over at about 11 o'clock midnight to the biggest theater pretty much in Portland and watched Slumdog Millionaire, and it was nice. Big empty theater and late at night, and basically the first people in Oregon to see Slumdog Millionaire, which I believe still currently is only playing in select cities, which is of course a euphemism for New York, LA. Slumdog Millionaire, set in Mumbai, and is fantastic. However, getting off of that bright note, let's get into, I have two massive postings, the first of which jumps back to November 30th. Mumbai attack updates, false flag, UK intel ops, and questions. The first one boils it down a bit from my man Lee Rogers at roguegovernment.com. Mumbai attacks look like a Western intel op. The recent terrorist attacks in Mumbai, India appear to be the work of a Western intelligence agency. Sophisticated terrorist attacks are usually only executed by an institution with a vast amount of resources at their disposal and not by terrorists living in a cave somewhere. History has shown that high-profile terrorist attacks which are getting top billing in the media are in fact government-sponsored. Already, India is blaming Pakistan for the attacks, and we've also seen the onslaught of propaganda from media outlets attempting to place the blame for the attack on the fictional CIA-founded organization called Al-Qaeda. There are even eyewitness accounts saying that the attackers did not look like Indians, but instead appeared to be Western. In fact, some of the attackers have already been identified as British citizens of Pakistan origin. Of course, none of that matters since the media needs to sell the Al-Qaeda myth to the dumbed-down masses here in America. Considering that Barack Obama has gone on the record to talk about the possibility of using military force in Pakistani territory to go after Al-Qaeda terrorists, it looks as if this event is going to conveniently provide him the excuse to do so when he takes power in just a few months, if not almost now, just over a month. He can say he's going after Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and the media will sell it as the right thing to do. Let's face it, the only groups that would gain from the killing and wounding of hundreds of innocent people in India are Western governments. It's allowing them to continue to sell the phony terror war to the dumbed-down American sheep. It effectively plays off India against Pakistan and provides the excuse for future U.S. military intervention into Pakistan. And again, who's the string puller who knows how to play countries off each other to go after the bear? That's Brzezinski. That's, of course, just a little bit of Lee Rogers' article, Mumbai Attacks Look Like a Western Intel Operation. Some of the links in there take you to The Telegraph as well as Reuters. And, of course, you can read about how some of them were identified as British citizens. And we'll get deeper and deeper. Other updates, of course, from InfoWars, a whole long list of videos, a word from my man Greg Nixon, a daily dose of terror, Mumbai attacks pave way for Obama into Pakistan. And again, you'll hear some of these early reports, the counter reports from the alternative media like Lee Rogers and Greg Nixon. Was when, in the early stages, they were, of course, trying to pin it on Al-Qaeda. That hasn't really panned out so well for them. Regardless, from Greg Nixon, as soon as you hear the name Al-Qaeda, just insert U.S. in its place. Obama and Brzezinski want to make a foray into Pakistan and start a larger war in the East, Russia-China. This apparent false flag attack is to get the ball rolling. Not had the chance to comb through the drill archives for Mumbai, but recall several exercises in the preceding months. There's almost little point in debunking these scams anymore. Independent researchers quickly exposed 7/7 in London and 9/11 as false flag is now mainstream, but the perps still roam freely and are openly stealing our money. So that's an interesting note, of course, to dig into the terror drill war game archives and see what was going on in the last couple months in Mumbai, India. I believe ultimately it was 5 U.S. citizens were ultimately killed in the Mumbai attacks, and that's an AFP raw story link for you. There's also a video of Indian commandos storming the Jewish center, but we'll jump to The Telegraph. Mumbai attack: British men among the terrorists. 2 British-born Pakistanis were among 8 gunmen seized by Indian commandos who stormed buildings to free hostages. Vilasro Deshmukh, the chief minister of Mumbai, reportedly said. The Foreign Office earlier said it was investigating reports on NDTV, a local television news channel, that the terrorists, who swarmed luxury hotels and other tourist sites in the cities, included, quote, British citizens of Pakistani origin. The development came as Gordon Brown called for international coordination to combat terrorism in the wake of the attacks. He said, quote, "We've got to look at how international action against terrorism can be improved." On the claim that Britons could have been among the perpetrators, he said, "I would not want to be drawn into early conclusions about this." But of course, he says, whether he's talking about the war of terror or the war of stealing your money, we of course need more global international action and coordination. A new world order, if you will. British intel is behind Mumbai massacre. That actually comes from Lyndon LaRouche, LaRouchePack.com. But if we jump to ex-CIA, interesting individual Robert Baer, of course, always writing interesting things on Time.com, Mumbai perpetrators showed combat training. 3 days after the Mumbai attacks, it is unclear who's behind them, and that in itself tells a story. Terrorism experts have been all over television and the internet speculating on the identity of the perpetrators, more often than not attempting to divine their identity from the group's tactics. The problem is that terrorists do not follow rule books. They learn and adapt from other groups. The fact that suicide bombers do not blow themselves up in the lobbies of the Oberoi or Taj hotels does not mean they are not from Al-Qaeda. Of course, you can see photos, thanks to Time, of chaos in Mumbai. But lastly, from Robert Baer, what we should be certain of, though, is that the Mumbai attackers were combat trained. And of course, we always get into the act. NYPD guards against Mumbai-like terror attacks. That's from WCBSTV.com. And of course, if you'll recall, the day of the Mumbai attacks, we woke up to early reports of boogie-boogie about the New York subways, and then internationally, boom, heightening it up, tit for tat. Lastly, on this first page, updates from Danger Room, India to mobilize in aftermath of Mumbai attacks. The commando-style terror attacks that killed around 200 people in Mumbai, India last week have been compared to the 9/11 attacks in the U.S. 8 years ago. It's war, the Times of India proclaimed in an editorial with a link for you. And of course, there's also other links to other Danger Room articles and many other things that I probably glossed over as I was scrolling down. Many things, Google, AP, you name it. That's the first post of updates. False flag, UK intel ops, and questions. The second one, the one I just posted up in the last couple of hours. More Mumbai updates, foreknowledge, hoax call, and double cover. First, from 9/11 blogger, CIA foreknowledge of Mumbai attacks. On November 29th, OutlookIndia.com, with a link for you, reported that the CIA's station chief in Delhi approached one of India's intelligence agencies, the Research and Analysis Wing, with a link for you, and passed on a fairly specific warning. Quote, from OutlookIndia.com, in mid-September this year, the CIA station chief in Delhi sought an urgent meeting with his counterpart in RNAW to pass on some critical inputs. This was part of an understanding that India and American intelligence had institutionalized in the aftermath of 9/11. From its assets in Pakistan and Afghanistan, American intelligence had come to learn that the Lashkar-e-Toiba was planning to launch a major terrorist attack in Mumbai, which would be carried out from the sea. By the middle of November, as Indian intelligence continued to check out further inputs, the pieces of an intricate jigsaw puzzle began to fall into place. Sources say they learned that the attack would come from the sea and that the Taj Hotel would be a major target. But the hotel eased those security enhancements the week before the attack, according to the chairman of the company that owned the hotel where it took the brunt of the attacks. There's a link to CNN for you. I don't think I have to point out the similarities, and of course they're already referencing 9/11 within the article, and then they just happen to mention that, of course, their security and defenses were called down, stood down, called off, redirected. Sounds like 9/11 to me. Sounds like JFK to me. Sounds like Pearl Harbor to me. Sounds like OKC to me. Sounds... From ABC News, U.S. warned India in October of potential attack. U.S. intelligence agencies warned their Indian counterparts in mid-October of a potential attack quote, from the sea against hotels and business centers in Mumbai, a U.S. intelligence official tells ABCNews.com. A second government source says specific locations, including the Taj Hotel, were listed in the warning. 1 month later, November 18th, Indian intelligence also intercepted a satellite phone call to a number in Pakistan known to be used by a leader of the terror group Lashkar-e-Taiba, believed responsible for the attack. The Indian intercept also revealed a possible seaborne attack, the officials say. So, more backup, more corroboration of prior knowledge and forewarnings. If we move to India Today, .in, we were trained by the Pakistan Navy, says captured terrorist Azam Amir, A-Z-A-M-A-M-I-R. Azam Amir, the terrorist who was held by the Mumbai police, has made some striking revelations regarding the Mumbai terror attacks. Azam has disclosed that the Pakistan Navy had trained the terrorist in boating and swimming to carry out the attacks in Mumbai. Azam was arrested on Wednesday from Girgaum Chowpatty in an encounter with the police. Ismail Khan, an accomplice of Amir, reportedly died in the gun battle. Sources say Azam has also revealed that people from gangster Dawood Ibrahim's gang helped the terrorist from Karachi in organizing the attacks. We're going to get to Dawood Ibrahim in just a moment. But first, an article from Paul Joseph Watson. Mumbai terrorists were aided by Indian authorities. Numerous disturbing details now strongly indicate that the terrorists who indiscriminately slaughtered nearly 200 people in Mumbai were aided by some elements of the Indian security apparatus responsible for protecting the city, with a link to belfasttelegraph.co.uk. It's now been confirmed that the Indian security services received numerous precise warnings that terrorists were planning to arrive by sea and attack the Taj Mahal Hotel, but if anything, security was relaxed, allowing the terrorists to prolong the attack for days and not hours. The CIA station chief in Delhi told Indian intelligence in September that terrorists were planning to arrive via sea and attack the Taj with small arms and bombs. Security measures around the hotel were increased in response to the warning, but relaxed just days before the attack. This was just one of, quote, a series of warnings of a possible attack on Mumbai by sea in the months leading up to the devastating onslaught. With that's a quote and a link to the AFP. As soon as an attack in Mumbai began to unfold, despite confusion as to its perpetrators and its motives, U.S. aircraft carriers were moving towards the Pakistan border. As we predicted right from the beginning, no matter who the real perpetrators were, the attack was always going to be blamed on Pakistan as a means of reigniting a nuclear war that reaped massive profits for the military-industrial complex who armed both sides the last time such tensions peaked at the start of the decade. The first link within there takes us to, which always double-check it, it's Debka file. It's out of Israel. It's one of those shady sources, but in a way, they're all shady sources. It's all data mining. So the Debka file had Monday, December 1st, U.S. masses, naval, air, marine might, and Arabian Sea opposite India, Pakistan, and Iran. So there's the source for that. Again, CernigNewsHog.blogspot.com, of course, goes into U.S. helping fuel the India-Pakistan arms race. And, of course, the usual suspects are there: Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, the military-industrial complex. And those are just the ones whose names we know really well. Moving down the list, getting more current, getting us more up-to-date, Mumbai terror evidence being deliberately ignored. That's one from packalert.wordpress.com, P-A-K, Pakistan, packalert. But jumping back to the Associated Press, accused is one of ours. India Counterinsurgency Agency says one of the two Indian men arrested for illegally buying mobile phone cards used by the gunman in the Mumbai attacks was a police officer who may have been on an undercover mission. That said by security officials in demanding his release. The arrests announced in the eastern city of Calcutta were the first since the bloody siege ended. So, you have India's counterinsurgency group saying, hey, that guy's with us. He was doing a special mission. But if we jump to Kurt Nimmo for a little more on this, arrest provides more evidence India, Israel, and U.S. behind Mumbai attacks. It's becoming increasingly a hard sell to pin the blame for the Mumbai attacks on Pakistan and thus set the stage for an attack on Pakistan after Obama enters the White House in a few weeks. It now appears Indian intel played a large part in the attacks. Last Saturday, the Associated Press reported that a, quote, counterinsurgency police officer who may have been on an undercover mission, end quote, was arrested for illegally buying mobile phone cards used by the gunman. The counterinsurgency operative, Mukhtar Ahmed, M-U-K-H-T-A-R-A-H-M-E-D, Mukhtar Ahmed worked for the police in Indian Kashmir. The implications of Ahmed's involvement, that Indian agents may have been in touch with the militants and perhaps supplied the SIM cards used in the attacks, aided to the growing list of questions over India's ill-trained security forces, which are widely blamed for not thwarting the attacks. Again, reporting from the Associated Press. In other words, Indian intelligence had penetrated Lashkar-e-Taiba and ran a false flag op through the terrorist group putatively connected to the Pakistan's ISI. In other words, what Kurt Nimmo's saying, it looks like Indian intel got inside the group and pulled off the false flag to blame it on Pakistan. Links again in there, Associated Press, opednews.com, again, packalert.wordpress.com, Alex Constantine, and there's also, and I'm not going to go through it all, but it's of course interesting, Lori Price and Citizens for Legitimate Government, legitgov.org. She's building another massive oddities page. Of course, there's a fantastic one about the Virginia Tech shooting, the Cho oddity page, but now she's got up the Mumbai oddities page, so definitely hit that up. But we're going to now shift to another one. This is from Steve Watson. This gets into another area, and again, the 9/11 similarities, the more I go through this, are pretty hard to miss. Pakistan asserts hoax call was real. You could basically call this, was this the Angel is Next call? Pakistan asserts hoax call was real. Again, from Steve Watson, Infowars.net, Pakistani officials have asserted that the so-called hoax phone call to its president, Zardari, on November 28th, which threatened war in response to the Mumbai attacks, was in fact real, and that Indian High Commission officials have since circulated a report in the media suggesting it was false. Pakistan Information and Broadcasting Minister Sherry Rehman, R-E-H-M-A-N, has stated that the call was put out from, quote, a verified official phone number of the Indian Ministry of External Affairs.
The Mumbai attacks were still ongoing when a phone call from India was reportedly put through to the president of Pakistan. India was already blaming Pakistan-based militants for the terror strike, and tension between the nuclear-armed neighbors was dangerously high. A Pakistan government spokesman says caller ID showed India's foreign ministry was on the line, supposedly the foreign minister himself, and has claimed the tone of the call was so threatening that Pakistan scrambled its air force to prepare for an attack. But the suspicious call may have been a hoax. Routine checks were skipped before Pakistan's president got on the line, according to CBS News consultant Farhan Bukhari.
Richard, that is the big mystery in this entire situation. In the middle of very high tensions after the Mumbai blast, it seems that those procedures may have been set aside.
Meeting with Secretary of State Rice sent to the region to cool both sides, India's foreign minister reportedly denied making any threatening call. One suggestion is that Pakistan may have fallen for a high-tech hoax, which Islamabad rejects.
The view from the Pakistani side is that no matter how sophisticated technology, there are certain things which only happen in the movies.
Who made the call, if it happened, isn't clear, but in the aftermath of Mumbai, mistrust is as plain as ever, with India accusing its neighbor of exporting terror and Pakistan claiming it was almost drawn into war. Richard Roth, CBS News, London.
Pakistan asserts the hoax call was real. There are links within that story to The Guardian, to McClatchy, to Kashmiri Times, to Raw Story, and to spacewar.com. Moving again to Danger Room. And now it starts to get scary. Mumbai terror group trained American jihadists. A growing chorus of intelligence officials in the U.S. and in South Asia have pinned the Mumbai attacks on the Kashmir-based militants Lashkar-e-Taiba. But there's been hardly any mention of the extremist group's deep ties to American-based jihadists. Since 2003, at least five U.S. citizens have been convicted in federal court of conspiring to provide material support to Lashkar-e-Taiba. At least nine more men considered to be in the same larger circle have been convicted of firearms violations and other felonies. There's a link in a partial list, investigativeproject.org. Several other cases are still making their way through the legal process. And there you have the connection to white Al-Qaeda. Violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism, H.R. 1955, or whatever it's changed its name to. The shift and the focus is going to come back home. Again, I've said it's going to be, in a way, I feel, the repeat of what the 90s were. It's going to shift back, and it's going to be all about violent abortion protests and militias and white Al-Qaeda. Jumping to one from Jeffrey Hammond. It's a long one. We'll just hit a little bit of it. Foreignpolicyjournal.com. Role of alleged CIA asset in Mumbai attacks being downplayed. Recent press reports on developments with regard to last month's attacks in Mumbai, India, indicate the role of Dawood Ibrahim, a wanted crime boss, terrorist, and drug trafficker, is being downplayed, possibly the result of a deal taking place behind the scenes between the governments of the U.S., Pakistan, and India to have others involved in the Mumbai attacks turned over while quietly diverting attention from a man who some say could reveal embarrassing secrets about the CIA's involvement in criminal enterprises. Dawood Ibrahim has a Wikipedia entry. Oh, and his birthday's coming up, December 26th. Dawood Ibrahim, the head of the organized crime syndicate D Company in Mumbai. He's currently on the wanted list of Interpol for organized crime and counterfeiting. He was also number 4 on the Forbes World's Top 10 Most Dreaded Criminals list in 2008. And of course, there's lots of links and references to drug smuggling and money laundering and underworld dons and crime bosses and terrorists and Muslims and Pakistan and research and analysis wing and Bollywood. So, Dawood Ibrahim, alleged CIA asset, and again, the 9/11 comparisons become staggering. Lastly, on this more Mumbai updates post, Foreknowledge, hoax calls, and double cover. It's the double cover part. Winterpatriot.blogspot.com. Excellent site, excellent blogger, excellent writer. Has an amazing 5-part and counting series of articles on the Mumbai attacks called Double Cover. Part 1, nothing can ever be the same. Part 2, what is a commando raid? Part 3, what is a false flag attack? Part 4, beyond ridiculous. And the most recent and current, Part 5, lining up the suspects. And those are both long and interesting and well-sourced and well-put articles about the fairly surely false flag attack in Mumbai. I'll, of course, stay on top of it as I'm drowning in news, and I believe this will be one of the shorter B-side editions of Media Monarchy that I've done for you. Or maybe kind of overwhelmed and kind of in a bad mood, and it's cold and yeah. But I thank you for listening. I appreciate it, my friends. Thank you for joining me for these weekly rants about the world and news and alternative news and politics and conspiracies and cover-ups and media and predictive programming and all those things. Join me what'll be tomorrow for episode 103 of MediaMonarchy.com. Until then, my name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.